Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Ken Auletta, whose latest book is Backstory Inside the Business of News, consisting of pieces mostly printed in The New Yorker. Ken Auletta's most recent piece, in January, Fortress Bush, How the White House Keeps the Press Under Control, in The New Yorker, and I want to talk a little bit about that as well. Ken Auletta, you've written several pieces on media, meaning that there must be some that you did not include in here. Why did you make the choices you did?
Well, I was trying to explore several themes in the book that I think are relevant to contemporary journalism. One theme is the culture clash between these giant companies that increasingly own journalistic entities and the journalistic entities themselves. And the business people who own the media companies tend to talk about synergy and teamwork and lowering the wall between divisions and cost cutting and getting our profit margins and stock price up. And the journalists, on the other hand, talk about when they hear the word synergy, they think of shilling. When they hear the word teamwork, they say, no, our culture is not about teamwork. It's about an adversarial system. When they hear about lowering the walls between divisions, they hear, you want the advertising people in the newsroom. We don't want them in the newsroom. And cost-cutting is, of course, anathema if it means cutting overseas bureaus or enterprise reporting. So there is this battle. I was interested in that theme. I was interested in another theme, which is that a lot of play goes out to the question, is there a media bias? Is it a conservative bias? Is it a liberal bias? And you can find examples of both biases. But that's not the dominant bias in the media today. And by having some of the stories I have in there, I was trying to illustrate that the dominant bias today is a market-driven bias. It's a bias for ratings and circulation. And curiously enough, this is a view held not just by people like Eric Alterman or Al Franken on the left, but it's held by the Bush White House and many people in politics, and as came out in the piece you described earlier, Fortress Bush. So I was interested in that theme. And another theme I was interested in exploring, which I do by talking about the lecture fees that journalists get and the know-it-allism that our national pundits often exhibit when they go on the air and bloviate, is that one of the important ingredients of being a good journalist is having humility. The humility to ask questions and actually listen to what people say and to follow up that way. And increasingly, we've lost that. And I think that's a major loss. And it's one of the reasons why the public sees us as arrogant. And it's one of the reasons why people like the Bush White House don't feel they have to answer our questions.
That brings up a very, very good point, because there's a quote here from the cheat sheet we get, which consists of questions and answers, and usually toss them away and ask my own questions. I'm not going to ask the question, but I'm going to read you the quote, and then I want you to relate it to your article, Fortress Bush. A good journalist is an educator, has as much of a calling as a public official. In a democracy, people depend on the information they receive from journalists to help them make decisions. That's not a small responsibility. That's your quote. In Fortress Bush, you specifically say that the people in the Bush White House totally disdain the press, and they do not think the press is important in a democracy.
They think that the press is a special interest, and they see us as not representing the public interest, but representing more gotcha, more headlines, more get the circulation up, get the ratings up. And therefore, we're more interested in sizzle than steak. That is a view, by the way, that is shared by many people, including people on the left, but shared by Bill Clinton and Howard Dean today. And they're not wrong about that part of it, but I think they are wrong about the notion that we are a special interest. Many reporters I know, not all by any means, get up in the morning and they see themselves as performing a public function in democracy, a check and balance function, a function of deciphering the truth, getting the information to the people. We do a very imperfect job of that, but that's our job. And I don't think the Bush people respect that that is part of our job, and I think they're wrong about that.
Bush got a free ride for a long time, and when I'm reading this, what I see is not so much the view that the press is a special interest, even though they may say that, but that they perceive themselves as being the CEOs of a corporation controlling advertising. And that's the way it appears to me.
Well, they do see themselves that way. I mean, every administration, including City Hall administration, state governments, or the Bush administration, see themselves that there's a battle that goes on behind the scenes every day between who's going to be on offense and who's going to be on defense. The Bush people see themselves as CEO, as you said, and their job every day is, what are we going to market today? What are we going to sell today? And the press sees itself not as pushing a particular story, but basically reacting to the news. And so the Bush people are trying to flood the press with stories, their stories, so the Bush people stay on the offensive. In the weapons of mass destruction story, which you allude to, and I report on in this piece, Bush got a free ride from the press. I mean, the truth of the matter is that the Bush administration, led by the president himself, made a series of assertions, factual assertions, about weapons of mass destruction that Iraq had, that have proven to be false. The press treated this like a ping-pong match. Ping, pong, ping, pong. One side says something, you get the other side say something else. They felt they didn't have Democrats to go to who were critical of Bush, but there are a lot of other people who were. Our job is not to be a conveyor belt for false facts, but as best we can to try and decipher, are these facts correct or not? Or are they assertions that are not yet provable? And we didn't do that in the case of weapons of mass destruction. And I think the press bears a major responsibility for that.
The press seems to have forgotten the difference between marketing and news at that point.
Well, we didn't do a good job. Part of it is that it was a wartime situation. The press gets caught up in the patriotic fervor and of that. Part of it was that they saw that there was no Democratic opposition to go to. But part of it is, I just think, mindless. And we ought to hold the press accountable as we should be holding Bush or anyone else in public life accountable.
What about the concept that the embedding was, rather than just giving a bird's eye view, co-optation?
Well, you can make that argument. On the other hand, I would make another argument, which is that if you could actually see war up close, real war, not from a distance, as most of us do when we cover a war, but see it and get to know soldiers as people, not as stereotypes or stick figures. That's a very valuable thing to have. It's a danger in that your lives are dependent on the people you're writing about or reporting on, and B, you're seeing a very narrow slice. It's a very tunnel view of the world. But I can make an argument that there's something to be said for embedding if we do it well.
There's something to be said for it if the reporter feels free enough to comment on both sides of the issue.
Yeah, I think the other thing, though, I would actually raise, if you're going to be embedded on the theory that you're going to show your readers or viewers or listeners real war, then you've got to show them what happens in real war, and that we don't do. We tend to shield the public from the ugly pictures of casualties, and I don't think we should. I think if you're going to be embedded, I think you show real war.
But that comes back to the question of the relationship between embedding and Bush marketing.
Well, it also comes back to other things like the TV networks or the TV people who would embed their reporters. They don't want to offend their viewers by showing ugly pictures of dead children and amputated limbs.
That's true, too. One other element in Fortress Bush concerns access. And we hear a lot about access, particularly access to the presidency. There's a feeling, at least out here on the left coast, that one of the reasons that the press is kind to Bush is because they want to maintain access. You posit in Fortress Bush that it really doesn't matter because they're not going to hear anything anyway.
They don't grant much access. The people who work in the White House, except for the people who work in the press function offices, don't return calls to reporters, or by and large. Very rarely do they. So there's not a lot of access to the Bush people. In fact, the way the White House reporters have to report their stories is through a process that they call triangulation, which is they have to go up to the Hill and from the Hill find out what do you think is going on at the White House, then go to the think tanks and the other people who allied with the conservative Bush administration, find out what they think is going on, and then use that information, triangulate it, to come back to the White House and try and squeeze something out of the Bush people.
When you report on something like this, when you write something like this, are you aware in the back of your mind, does it bother you that an article too critical could limit your own access or the New Yorkers, or is that completely irrelevant?
This is a story. I was visiting Planet Bush. I don't live on Planet Bush. I'm not going back to Planet Bush anytime soon. So I wasn't thinking I'm going to alienate myself from either Bush people or, by the way, the press people I'm writing about. That's an easy call there. There's always a question when you're doing, you know, if you have a beat, are you going to offend the people you're writing about? My attitude, particularly if you work for a relatively important publication, is you can't offend them. That ultimately they need you more than you need them. I think that's the attitude a reporter should have. That you go into that story and that even if they stop talking to you for a week or 2 weeks, they'll come back because they need the press. Bush is actually challenging that assumption.
That's what I was going to ask about.
And he's basically saying, I don't need them. And if, in fact, that becomes the norm, obviously the press has to figure out other ways to do our job.
Part of the press is Fox News, whether we like it or not. Fox News, New York Post, The Washington Times. Obviously, they will still continue to get access. Does that apply additional pressure to the mainstream press?
Well, interestingly enough, I have the final chapter is a profile of Fox News.
Right.
And the Fair and Balanced Network. Yuck, yuck. One of the things that's curious is that Fox News has not enjoyed extraordinary access to the Bush administration, even though you could argue their coverage has generally been more favorable to the Bush administration. They got their first interview, Britt Hume got last September for Fox News, and Tom Brokaw got one before that for NBC. The Bush people are very tough-minded about the press and tend to view all of us in a similar way, which is that they're our adversaries.
So, Ken Auletta, you're suggesting that Karl Rove and Roger Ailes do not have a special relationship then?
I think they have a relationship that Ailes can get Rove on the phone, and I suspect at the time of the Geraldo Rivera contretemps, where the military wanted Rivera out of Afghanistan and out of Iraq, because he had drawn a map in the sand in which he showed where American troops were and how they were maneuvering, and they thought that was giving away our position and our strategy. And I know that Roger Ailes made some phone calls. I don't know who he made them to in the Bush administration, but obviously it lessened the backlash against Geraldo Rivera and saved his job. Nevertheless, Karl Rove doesn't appear on Fox News, nor do other senior officials in the Bush administration a tremendous amount, because their attitude is that, you know, we have a job to do. We don't have to, and talking to the press is not part of our job.
Well, Ken Auletta, in a book like Backstory, or when you're reporting on someone like Ailes and Fox News, you're trying to create a portrait. And when you're creating a portrait, to some degree, if you're doing your job, there must be a certain amount of sympathy there.
Absolutely. You're showing human being. My job as a journalist is to understand people. When I have the luxury that The New Yorker gives me or a book gives me of time and space, the Ailes piece is 20,000 words. It ran in The New Yorker. I had the luxury of spending 3-4 months to try and understand him and what assumptions animate him, what drives this guy. He's a man who is not just successful because he has a political agenda. He's a very good producer, and he started as a producer. He's also a great character with a great sense of humor, and I convey that. He's also a killer, and I convey that. He's also a guy who uses his airwaves to settle scores with people, and I convey that. You know, when we read a biography of someone, one of the things that separates a good biography from a bad biography is a sense of a marble portrait, a complicated figure. And so I was actually embedded at Fox News during the war, watching their coverage every day. And I tried to reflect in that piece that it wasn't fair and balanced and that really had an agenda.
It's a year later. What do you see of Fox News reflecting back on that maybe you couldn't say in that article?
Nothing I couldn't say in the article, but I would have said then, as I would say now, that I am very troubled by this European model of basically opinionated journalism that is often where the opinions are supposedly hidden behind a slogan, fair and balanced, in this case, and that people will come to have, as we had in the early 19th century in America, newspapers that were vehicles of particular political parties. I don't want to have that. You often have that in Europe. Journalism. I don't want to have that in America. I actually think the crisis we're going through in American business today and the scandals that we've witnessed, one of the things that comes out of that is the need for, and the phrase is used often, transparency. I believe you should have transparency in journalism too. And that is to say, I don't think journalists ought to have hidden agendas. I think it ought to be, if they have an agenda, if there's a columnist has an agenda, it's clear by reading their column. But if you're going to claim to be fair and balanced, then you ought to be fair and balanced.
How do you compare spending time with someone like Roger Ailes to spending time with, say, Harvey Weinstein of Miramax?
I enjoyed spending more time with Ailes because he has a better sense of humor. You know, they're both people who I would not emulate in my own life. And yet both are people of prodigious talent. Miramax has done a lot of really good movies. but he's also a thug, Harvey Weinstein. And I tried to describe him as both this talented man, but also as this thug. He hated the piece, which is not in the book, but it a New Yorker piece 2 years ago. If Harvey Weinstein had liked the piece, I really would have been disappointed. Roger Ailes had a more complicated reaction, I think, to the piece. I think he went up and down. In the end, he probably didn't like it very much, and certainly a lot of people at Fox News didn't like it. And that's par for the course. But again, it's not a planet I'm going back to.
You're listening to an interview with Ken Auletta, whose recent book is Backstory, Inside the Business of News. Getting back to politics for a second, I'm going to use the phrase here, media whore, because it's one that seems to be making the rounds. The obvious people, when we think of the right-wing pundits, people like Ann Coulter, Michael Savage, but we could also include in that people who might not be quite as much in the right wing. Some might include people like Paul Lazon or Chris Matthews or even Diane Sawyer. Frank Rich wrote an article about Diane Sawyer and how she came down hard on the deans. The question is, what are they doing? Do they have a sense of how the punditry is affecting America, and how much is money involved in that?
Diane Sawyer's interview with Mr. and Mrs. Dean was a particularly disgusting spectacle to watch. Does he have a temper? Does he ever get mad at you? What does he get mad at you for? He gives you a rhododendron plant for your birthday? Are you satisfied with that? I mean, it was so frivolous and silly, and yet it had a point, which is the larger point I would make about it. A lot of times these interviews are driven by a desire for ratings, by that market bias that we were talking about before. They sit in there and they say, what do we do in this Howard Dean and his wife interview today that everyone in the press will pick up on? And they'll notice it was Diane Sawyer asking the questions. We'll have to play our tape, our little excerpt of the gotcha question, that great wow moment. And that's what they think about. And they think about that in part because they're all living in a world where people have many, many more sources of information. The audience erodes for the network. So they say, how do we get more people in the tent? So what they tend to do is become a desperate carnival barker. And they raise their voice and they scream and they pull stunts. And that was a stunt. And a lot of Michael Savage and Coulter are stunts. They're stunt people. They're trying to draw attention to themselves. They're certainly not reporters. She's not a reporter. He's not a reporter. Far from it. But you know, it's the Howard Stern principle. You say the most outrageous things and you draw attention to yourself.
But what happens with someone like Chris Matthews, who started his career as a first-rate journalist?
I would never call Chris Matthews a first-rate journalist, including when he was at the San Francisco Chronicle. He wrote a very good book called Hardball, actually, right after he left Speaker O'Neill, Tip O'Neill. I mean, he's a man who has some talent, and he also has some talent for asking sometimes good questions. But he's infatuated with his own opinion. And he doesn't let anyone talk and finish a sentence. I mean, that's not a journalist. A journalist is someone who has the humility to ask questions and listen to the answers.
So then we come back to a combination of two things here, money and humility, which brings up another piece from Backstory, Ken Auletta, a piece called Fee Speech. Eric Alterman, in his book, What Liberal Media, makes a great point of the relationship of money and the relationship of the media synergy, as you call it. He doesn't talk that much about the relationship of what these people say on the air or how much they say it and how much money they get off the air.
One of the things, and I do this in that piece you mentioned in the book, Fee Speech, is that in that piece what I did was I went to about 50 pundits, many of them Washington, not all of them Washington. Chris Matthews was certainly one of them. Tim Russert was another one, Ted Koppel, Britt Hume, et cetera, et cetera. And I asked them, the speeches you make, how many do you do a year? What groups do you do them before? What do you get paid? In most cases, they refuse to answer the question. They act just like the politicians they assail for not answering their questions. And one of the reasons that they say such sharp things on television is because they're basically auditioning to attract lecture fees, to go out and lecture. And lecture people want entertainers to come and entertain their business group. you know, Chris Matthews was one of the people who answered the question and answered it honestly. He said, I give them the same speech all the time. They just want to be entertained. And he told me how much he made on that. You're talking about people making a lot of money doing this who are journalists, and sometimes they're taking money from people that they cover. So it's a blatant conflict of interest at times.
There's a point where you discuss how much Michael Kinsley gets, the only liberal, one of the few liberals you talk to, compared to how much the conservatives get.
The conservatives are
they can go to corporations.
They go to they speak before corporations, which pay the bigger bucks. A guy like Kinsley gets invited to colleges, which don't pay the big bucks. But Kinsley gave me an answer in that piece, which I don't agree with. He said, "It's no one's business what I get paid." I think it is. I think transparency works for journalists as well as for corporations. And if we want to know what Dennis Kozlowski of Tyco or Kenneth Lay of Enron is getting or under the books or under the table, then we have the same right to ask that of the people who are in a democracy providing us with essential information.
That's why William Safire's answer is, yeah, I do it for money. I do everything for money. Pay me enough, I'll just do it.
I'm
a capitalist with a big C. It's very refreshing. At least it's honest. But on the other hand, this is a guy who is attempting to convince people about certain political things and state facts, and yet he acknowledges he does it all for money.
I think he's wrong, and I think we should know the groups he's speaking before. If, for instance, William Safire, which he does, writes often about Israel, is he receiving money and how much from groups that maybe he's quoting or reflecting their viewpoint? Now, clearly, he has his own viewpoint, which is very strong in that area.
Ken Auletta, there are media critics, people who involve themselves with the media. One of them is Howard Kurtz, and Eric Altman makes the charge that Kurtz is clearly in conflict of interest by being both on television and reporting on the media for the Washington Post. What do you think about that?
I think it's questionable whether I think Howie Kurtz is a good reporter, and I admire stuff. I admire stuff he does on CNN as well, but I think his charge at the Washington Post is to report on everyone, including CNN, so it raises legitimate questions.
Howell Raines resigned from the New York Times after the incident involving plagiarism. You, in your PS to it, because each of these essays has a little postscript about what you feel later. You felt that that was over the top, having him resign, that it wasn't necessary, or was it?
No, I think what wasn't necessary. I mean, Hal Raines didn't cheat in terms of Jason Blair. He didn't knowingly hide facts in terms of Jason Blair. What happened was that Hal Raines had a brilliant first 6 months as editor of the New York Times. He took over 5 days before 9/11. And for the next 6 months, the New York Times did some miraculous reporting. It was a great newspaper. The thing that made him successful in those 6 months were also the thing that made him unsuccessful and led to his failure. He was an autocrat. He didn't listen to people. He was a bully. And he never took his foot off the accelerator. He didn't pat people on the back. He didn't let them relax. He was just too intense. And so the Jason Blair thing became an excuse to get rid of him. What was unfair is to somehow tar a man, in this case Hal Raines, with the Jason Blair scandal. But the fact that he lost his job and maybe deserved to lose his job at some point is a different issue. But actually, in a larger sense, he wasn't fired because of the Jason Blair. He would have been fired instantly if that were true. The publisher stood up before a room full of Times staffers and said, I'm not going to fire Hal Raines. But over the next 3 weeks, he tried to get Hal Raines to change his autocratic management style. And he concluded 3 weeks later he was not capable of, A, changing his style, and, B, of regaining the confidence of his staff, which was lost not because of Jason Blair, but because of the abuse he had heaped on them for a year.
Was his style more autocratic, say, than the Rosenthal Geld years?
Well, in the last 3-4 years of Rosenthal, that was the gold standard for autocratic management at the Times. And the place was alienated, but there were no emails, there were no mass meetings of complaint back in the Rosenthal era, so it didn't circulate and become a kind of an echo chamber. Hal Raines walked into the echo chamber.
And how do you view the Times since he's left?
Well, it's settled down. It's people are happier. They've made some changes. The editors listen more to the staff and the other editors. So it's a happier place. Now, whether it has the energy and drive that it had under Hal Raines is one of the questions that we got. The jury's out on that, but obviously that's a question.
In that cheat sheet again, you're asked about the current state of journalism, and you say, I feel hopeful and depressed, hopeful because of new technologies, and depressed because of this synergy between advertising and journalism. But what about journalists themselves? Are journalists themselves being trained to be good journalists, or are they just being trained to get the gotcha story?
I think, good question. I think that I begin the book with a long essay about the state of journalism, and I talk about having served on the task force that Lee Bollinger, the incoming president of Columbia, had set up to look at what should the Columbia Journalism School do? What should its mission be? We wrestle with these questions. How do you train a good journalist? Is a journalism school worthy? Should it be a two-year rather than a one-year? And should it train people for the world as it exists to fit into the current world of journalism as it exists? Or should it train journalists for the world that we believe should exist? And we came to the latter conclusion. And he chose Nick Lemon, a wonderful reporter from The New Yorker, as the dean, to try and make journalism education better, as Orville Schell's trying to do it at Berkeley.
What about journalists themselves? Don't they need to be trained that this is journalism and not marketing?
Yeah, it's a calling. And, you know, I was over talking to Orville Schell recently, and who's the dean at Berkeley, and I said, you know, do you get a lot of pressure on you to teach marketing and public relations at the journalism school? He said, yeah. He said, but we're not going to do it. And we and the Columbia Journalism School are the two holdouts among journalism schools that won't do that. But other journalism schools increasingly do that. So much of news is marketing driven today, and that's very, very worrisome. And ultimately, the people who are running these companies are business people, and they're looking at ratings and circulation, and they're saying, why can't we have more Michael Jackson? Why can't we have more Lacey Peterson and O.J. Simpson and News You Can Use and J-Lo and all the others and Gotcha? It's very hard to fight that onslaught, but fight it we must, and we want to train journalists to understand why it's important to fight it, and hopefully also who have the personality and the persuasiveness to figure out how to communicate with their bosses so it's not, you know, if we get into man the barricade situation, we lose. They sign the checks. We don't.
You've been listening to an interview with Ken Auletta, whose book is Backstory, Inside the Business of News. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.